is like a fungus is brilliant. A fungus oozes and spreads and destroys, even if it doesn't have the intention to wreak havoc. There are ghosts of Plato and Augustine in this perspective, that evil represents the absence of good. For Arendt, Eichmann and his companions were evil because they didn't think through the ramifications of their actions, rather like drunken hit-and-run drivers. There is something about such thoughtlessness that allows it to spread inexorably, like a fungus. The experimentalists took up the issue of how this spreading occurred. The experimentalists reflected on Nuremberg and on life around them, and they came up with dispiriting conclusions about human nature itself. Milgram pointed out that people will all too readily suspend their judgment about right and wrong behavior. Given an authority figure who tells them to torture and potentially kill another human being, most people will in fact do so promptly. Latane and Darley observed that good intentions can be silenced in social settings. With increasing numbers of indifferent people around us, our sense of individual responsibility is diffused, and we lack the courage to intervene. Zimbardo introduced another dimension of thoughtless evil. Put a person in a role, and he will start to adopt that role unthinkingly. He will summon up observations from literature, from movies, from growing up, and he will start imitating those behaviors, even to the extent of assuming a mantle of brutality. All of these studies follow in the tradition of Douglas Kelly's observations. Evil happens all too easily, given the right social situation. But there is one large assumption behind all of these studies, that we come into the world tabula rasa, a blank slate to be shaped by our interactions with others. What if some of us don't have blank slates at all? What if the basic default position of some human beings is not neutral at all, but much darker than that? We take up these troubling questions in the next chapter. Chapter 12. Malice as Categorically Different, Encounters with the Other. Most men are bad. Bias, Greek philosopher, 6th century BCE. I have found little that is good about human beings on the whole. Most of them are trash. Sigmund Freud to Oscar Pfister, September 10, 1918. The battle lines were already drawn. On one side there was Douglas Kelly, who thought there was a bit of malice in everyone, and that it was socially determined. On the opposite side, Gustav Gilbert believed that the Nazi leader's malice constituted a special category of evil. Gilbert's view has roots in surprisingly diverse fields: theology, psychopathology, neuroscience, and law. If the Nuremberg trial were held today, the prosecution would portray the defendants as categorically evil, and the defense would argue that their sentences should be mitigated because the defendants had psychopathic personality disorder and/or brain damage. There are long traditions supporting these arguments, and some surprising insights from contemporary neuroscience research. What is the nature of man? Even Hermann Göring was drawn to this question. One evening, surrounded by the gloom in his prison cell, he confided in Gilbert that man is the biggest beast of prey there is. Because he has the brains for large-scale destruction, while other beasts of prey merely kill to eat when they are hungry. In a way, questions about the nature of man anticipate the problem of theodicy: how a morally perfect and omnipotent God permits bad things to happen. Many religious traditions regard life as a battleground between luminous good and brooding evil. In this context, evil is not just sin, that is, man's fault, but a manifestation of a malicious intentionality. One finds traces of this perspective, for instance, in Norse mythology, and it is, of course, well developed in Zoroastrianism. Even contemporary Catholicism struggles with a Manichaean legacy dating back to the 3rd century that recognizes a dualistic struggle between good and evil. Peter tells us, "Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour." 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. Paul shares that view, noting, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers, the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Ephesians chapter 6 verse 12. As so many popes have reminded us, the devil is real. Augustine subtly stepped back from Manichaeism by suggesting that evil, rather than being a force in its own right, was the absence of good. But secular thinkers like Einstein have also recognized the tangibility of evil by noting, "It is easier to denature plutonium than to denature the evil spirit of man." Years ago, when I graduated from college, the commencement speaker, discouraged by the riots, assassinations, and wars of the 1960s, offered a dark view of our future by quoting the 6th century BCE philosopher Bias, who summed up his view of the nature of man in just 4 words: "Most men are bad." These words have haunted me from time to time whenever I've encountered malice. But then I ran into Bias, literally, when I was in the Vatican's Hall of Philosophers, where his bust is prominently displayed. It seems odd that the Vatican honors a man whose opinion of humanity was so dark and pessimistic, but Bias summarized a worldview that is still widely felt. 2,000 years later, Thomas Hobbes shared Bias's pessimism about the nature of man, and concluded in his Leviathan, 1651, that in the state of nature, man's life is poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And Freud, of all people, shared that point of view as well. Most men are trash. Such views imply that the social psychologists are wrong, and that we are not born with a blank slate. Worse than that, some people's default position is neither benign nor neutral, but malevolent. Our prevailing positivism and optimism incline us to view evil as symbolic or inner, and we think that only eccentrics view evil as palpably external. Theology and philosophy are not alone, however, in considering malice as a distinct presence. Psychiatry and psychology recognize its unique signature in psychopaths, and Gilbert saw them everywhere he looked in Nuremberg. The psychopath's lack of empathy. When people were starting to think about the Nazi leaders as psychopaths, they were anticipating maniacs, monstrous psychopaths who enjoyed their violence. This assumption that the war criminals would be sadistic psychopaths caused no end of trouble at Nuremberg, because there are other types of psychopaths who are far more common. Individuals who are corrupt, occasionally charming, and vicious only when necessary. These psychopaths claw their way to the top and leave mayhem in their wake, not out of thrill-seeking or sadistic pleasure, but because others were simply in their way. Even more common are the black sheep found in any family, psychopaths who defy all norms, reject authority, and act only out of blind selfishness. All of them have in common a lack of empathy. Psychopaths have been described under different names for centuries. Psychiatrist Donald Black beautifully described how the term has evolved over the years. Around 1800, the French physician Philippe Pinel observed patients who had cloudbursts of violence and rage, but were not delusional or confused. He called these outbursts manie sans délire, mania without delirium. About the same time, the American psychiatrist Benjamin Rush described patients with chronic willful bad behavior, which he attributed to a defect in the mind. In 1850, the diagnosis had morphed into moral insanity, where intellect was preserved, but habits and behaviors had run amok. By 1890, individuals who manifested such behavior chronically were called psychopaths. The 19th-century Italian criminologist Cesare Lombroso felt that, in addition to their unsavory behavior, psychopaths were marked by anomalies in their physical appearance, such as facial asymmetries. They were indeed other. In 1941, American psychiatrist Hervé M. Cleckley published The Mask of Sanity, which suggested that a profound mental disorder lurked behind the psychopath's seemingly normal facade, thus the mask of sanity. Given the date of the publication, Cleckley's work was influential when the Nuremberg Tribunal convened. Cleckley asserted that the psychopath appeared normal, but in fact had profound impairment in the ability to understand emotions and interpersonal loyalties. He emphasized that psychopaths were typically unreliable people who could be superficially charming but had poor judgment. They were self-absorbed and had few emotional commitments. They broke rules and laws frequently and without remorse or guilt. Importantly, Cleckley did not think them insane because they knew right from wrong, acted with intentionality, and were free from psychosis. But they were very peculiar. Numerous studies support Cleckley's observations. Psychopaths have subtle deficits in the way they perceive the world and the people around them. They slough off blame because it is always somebody else's fault. For such people, remorse is a word in a foreign dictionary. Truth is fungible, and deceit is the norm. Cleckley noted that the psychopath's aberration is more pronounced than just breaking rules. After all, illegal activities and rule-breaking are common. However, the psychopath's transgressions are different. First off, their record of rule-breaking is lifelong, with onset in childhood, and is evident during good times and bad, peacetime and wartime. Second, psychopaths feel no guilt, shame, or empathy. Lots of us break rules, but we put ourselves in others' places and feel empathy for those we have hurt. Oddly, the psychopath has none of this. To the psychopath, we are all mere krill. A shark has no feelings about eating krill. It kills and eats. The psychopath's victim is in the way or has something the psychopath wants, like money or sex. Again, this does not happen just once or twice. It is an enduring pattern of predation. Psychopaths are also notorious for their rashness and impulsivity. It is providential for the rest of us that most criminal psychopaths get caught because of their recklessness. Although some psychopaths can be very calculating, such individuals fortunately are rare. Instead, most psychopaths do not learn well from their experiences. As a result, prisons are filled with careless psychopaths, like bank robbers who left their cell phones behind at the scene of the crime. Numerous studies show that psychopaths are indeed different in their response to stressors. Their impulsivity trips them up, and many of them may appear dumb, although their IQ is typically normal. Normal people respond to a stressor with increased sympathetic nervous system activity. Their heart rate increases, they start to sweat, and the stress is aversive to them. They learn. Psychopaths, however, are blind to stress. They respond in a wooden or blunted way, and they do not feel the aversive effects of their behavior. Put them in a stressful situation, and their body shakes it off. No increase in heart rate, no increase in sweating. This may sound advantageous, but it has a dark consequence. Psychopaths do not get feedback from their own bodies about dangerous behaviors. Some investigators feel that this defect in stress responsivity hampers learning and accounts for psychopaths' puzzling lack of guilt and impulsivity. Over time, psychiatrists began to differentiate among various types of psychopaths. First, there were inadequate types, cheats and vagrants, who weren't particularly aggressive. Then there were aggressive psychopaths, who were dangerous and violent. Then there were also creative psychopaths, eccentrics who ignored society's rules. Today, this category is now included in narcissistic personality disorder. The diagnostic territory of psychopathic personality, thus, has constantly shifted. When the first DSM was published in 1952, the overall term was sociopathic personality disturbance. At that point, psychiatry recognized four variants. Antisocial reaction. Patients were described as always in trouble, profiting neither from experience nor punishment, and maintaining no real loyalties. Frequently callous and hedonistic, showing marked emotional immaturity, with lack of sense of responsibility, lack of judgment, and an ability to rationalize their behavior so that it appears warranted, reasonable, and justified. That edition of the DSM distinguished between antisocial reaction and dissocial reaction. People in the latter group showed a disregard for the usual social codes because of living in an abnormal moral environment. They might well be predatory, but they had loyalties. Sexual deviation, the third variant of sociopathic personality disturbance, included sadism, homosexuality, fetishism, and pedophilia. Addiction was the fourth variant of sociopathic personality disturbance described in this early DSM. In 1945, one can thus see that witnesses found a special meaning in Goering's red nail polish and his drug addiction. To psychiatric observers, this buttressed his diagnosis as a psychopath. Today, a man wearing nail polish might be regarded as eccentric, and drug abuse would be so commonplace that it would not by itself lead to a diagnosis of psychopathic personality or antisocial personality disorder, as it is technically referred to now. Today, the term psychopath is reserved for people with severe antisocial personality disorder, and the diagnosis is typically based on a commonly used 20-item checklist. In 1945, the checklist approach was not available, and the Rorschach was considered a preeminent technique for diagnosing psychopathy and was recognized as such by the OSS and, of course, by Kelly and Gilbert. Even though psychopaths are callous and emotionally shallow, they can be haunted later in life by the shadow of lives they have ruined. They can and do get depressed and frequently seek solace in drugs and alcohol. Psychiatrists have a lot of familiarity with psychopaths because they are referred to us by their disconsolate spouses or by the courts. Psychopaths can respond to intensive psychotherapy, but the course is difficult. There is no pill for treating them, but some medications decrease impulsive irritability. If they come to the court's attention, the legal system tries to help us by trundling them off to jail. From Gilbert's point of view, the best treatment for the Nuremberg psychopaths was a hemp noose. Neuropsychiatry's quest for the bad brain. Psychiatry and psychology provide a clear description of psychopaths, but refrain from attributing a cause to the disorder. All of the usual suspects are blamed for psychopathy: crowded slums, bad parenting, bad genes, and brain injury. Numerous studies support each of these potential pathways, but ultimately, it comes down to the brain. There is a long tradition linking brain pathology to violence and criminal behavior. Mary Shelley anticipated this research in her novel about Frankenstein and his poorly cobbled-together creature with a defective brain who commits unspeakable crimes. But outside of fiction, there is also a centuries-old medical literature documenting, for instance, how syphilis or mercury toxicity could affect the brain, leading to irritability, dementia, and megalomania. It is no wonder that Nuremberg observers were on the lookout for neuropathology in the war criminals. The brain isn't just a 3-pound gelatinous adding machine. It has multiple parts that are organized topographically. In the 1930s, physicians recognized that the innermost part of the brain oversees the vital turbines of the body, breathing, heart rate, digestion, whereas the outermost part of the brain, the cortex, is in charge of thinking and evaluating. Sandwiched between these two areas is the limbic system, which helps us feel in response to the world. We would all be like a Tyrannosaurus Rex if our limbic system had its way. Fortunately, those limbic rages and lusts are modulated by our cortex. The large prefrontal cortex presides over it all, a traffic cop between thinking and feeling. If the prefrontal cortex is damaged, the brain's deeper structures acquire a louder voice, the timbre of behavior changes, and people become more impulsive, irritable, and morally lax. Whatever the cause of the injury, automobile accidents, athletic injuries, military combat, there is a link to impulsivity and violence, depending on the extent and location of the brain injury. Neuroscientists have reasoned that violence and psychopathy can emerge when either the top-down inhibitory action of the cortex is weakened or the bottom-up activity of the limbic system is enhanced. The brain has an elegant origami design, with layers of the brain folded in on themselves and deep crevices that result from all of that folding. Many of the folds, or sulci, provide landmarks that help us identify features of the brain more precisely. But in a way, the brain is also a complex macrame design, with neurons twisting and weaving around one another like an oddly designed freeway with on-ramps and exits that materialize willy-nilly. In 1848, an American railroad worker's accident led to one of the most influential case reports on brain injury and moral behavior. A 43-inch long tamping iron with a diameter of 1 1/4 inches blasted through Phineas Gage's head in an explosion. Yet surprisingly, he survived. But he wasn't the same. As his doctor famously observed, "The equilibrium or balance, so to speak, between his intellectual faculties and animal propensities seems to have been destroyed. He is fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanity, which was not previously his custom. Impatient of restraint or advice when it conflicts with his desires, at times pertinaciously obstinate, yet capricious and vacillating. A child in his intellectual capacity and manifestations, he has the animal passions of a strong man. His mind was radically changed, so decidedly that his friends and acquaintances said he was no longer Gage. Neuroscientists reconstructed the trajectory of the injury and inferred that the tamping iron had profoundly damaged Gage's left and right prefrontal cortex, located roughly behind the forehead on each side. Patients with such an injury have difficulties planning complex tasks that require flexibility and multitasking. Their emotional regulation is damaged, and they become moody and impulsive, while at the same time appearing indifferent in the wake of their outbursts. This starts to sound a bit like psychopathic behavior. Neural imaging. In 1945, it was difficult to study the brains of psychopaths. When patients like Robert Lay died, their brains could be sent for biopsy, but the tools for tracking the brain damage were somewhat coarser than today's. At the time of the Nuremberg trials, there were few instruments available to examine a living brain. One could observe the patient closely, or else wait for the eventual autopsy. There was little in between. Thus, when we try to second-guess the neuropathologists who examined Lay's brain, we must keep in mind what was knowable in 1945. Today we can use neural imaging to scrutinize neural circuitry. Not surprisingly, investigators have leapt at the opportunity to use such tools to study psychopaths' brains. From studies on brain-injured patients, we have a sense for regions of the brain that are involved in decision-making and emotional expression. The question arises, are these areas eroded in psychopaths? A growing literature suggests that psychopaths have defects in their prefrontal cortex, which contribute to their lack of judgment, difficulties in planning, and greater impulsivity. They also have reductions in the medial aspect of their temporal lobe, the amygdala to be precise, an area that helps regulate fear, emotionality, and threat perception. Many studies support these conclusions, but one by Martina Lai and colleagues gives a sense for the general approach. The investigators used structural magnetic resonance imaging to compare the brains of psychopathic and non-psychopathic prisoners. They found significant thinning in the cerebral cortex in the psychopaths, particularly in the areas of the brain that oversee planning and emotionality. It is almost as if one can see the reptilian brain burning through areas of the thinned cortex in the psychopaths. Functional imaging is slightly more complicated to grasp than structural imaging. In functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, one examines how different areas of the brain function or respond to certain tasks. The choice of tasks is important. If you contrasted eyes open versus eyes closed, that contrast would not be particularly informative for understanding psychopaths. However, if you used a task that examined impulsivity, that might be more useful. To examine impulsivity, one can ask a subject to perform a task, pressing a button every time he or she sees an X, and notice how often the subject jumps the gun by pressing the button when the X hasn't appeared on the screen. Similarly, scrutinizing how the brain responds to a task requiring an emotional judgment, empathy, can be informative. Obviously, there are many such tasks that could be employed, and many regions of the brain to be scanned. However, studying areas of the brain that serve emotional regulation, decision-making, and empathy might be highly informative for understanding how psychopaths think. In one study, 70 prisoners were divided into groups on the basis of high or low psychopathy scores. Then, the investigators showed the prisoners movie clips of people being intentionally hurt, struck, cut, crushed, fingers in a car door. Would the psychopath show any response of empathy? More important, would their brain regions involved in emotional regulation respond normally? In fact, the high scorers on the psychopathy scale differed profoundly. Their lack of empathy was not just on the surface, instead, in the depths of their brains. They were dead to watching another person's pain. Other studies have pointed out that psychopaths are poor in reading other people's emotional cues, and the brain region that is normally activated by such tasks stays ominously quiet in psychopaths. This neural imaging literature is fascinating, but it faces unique research challenges. Brain scans are so expensive that researchers rarely can afford to study large numbers of patients. In studies with small samples, random noise or confounding factors like drug abuse can complicate the inferences. Scientists are trained to be skeptical unless findings can be replicated, and precise replications in terms of type of scan, type of task, and area of the brain studied remain all too rare. Even subtle variations in the task can have major effects on the findings. For instance, asking patients to press a button with their left hand versus their right hand can affect the findings, thereby confusing the interpretation. What are the chances that an observation may be a fluke? When one examines large numbers of regions of interest in the brain, there is a chance of misidentifying a finding as significant when it is just a coincidence. One solution is to perform specialized meta-analyses that summarize findings across many studies while controlling for subtle differences in design. Researchers are just beginning to use such techniques to understand the neural imaging literature on psychopaths. I am an amateur photographer. Getting useful data from functional imaging experiments is a lot like taking a photo with a powerful telephoto lens. Unless you have a tripod, your pictures will be blurry. The tripod in the case of neural imaging is a precise research design. Without such precision, whatever pictures or insight we might get from such studies will be blurry. Mairead Dolan, one of the leading researchers in this area, summarized the problem succinctly. At present, too few methodologically sound brain imaging studies in those who have engaged in antisocial violence exist for definitive conclusions to be drawn. That sober assessment hasn't stopped the arguments in the courts. Neuroendocrine physiology. Neuroendocrine research examines how neurons communicate with each other, and recent studies suggest that the psychopath's neuronal communication signals are unusual. Two neurotransmitters, serotonin and oxytocin, have stirred considerable interest because of their peculiar regulation in psychopaths. Serotonin is involved in mood regulation, aggression, and impulsivity. Murderers, for instance, have lower levels of serotonin in their nervous system. It is interesting that medications like fluoxetine, which increase the bioavailability of serotonin, have been used informally to treat irritability and impulsivity. While disturbance in serotonin metabolism may contribute to psychopaths' impulsiveness and irritability, that disruption does not explain their callous indifference to others. An entirely different compound, oxytocin, may have relevance here. We used to think that oxytocin's main role was to increase uterine contractility, but research in the past 30 years has suggested a much broader role for oxytocin. Sites in the hypothalamus that produce oxytocin have neural links to the brain's emotional regulatory centers, as well as to the pituitary, which regulates much of the body's stress response. Initial research on oxytocin and emotion was performed on small, burrowing rodents called voles, which are about 7 inches long. It turns out that male prairie voles are strictly monogamous, help take care of their young, and are gregarious. In contrast, meadow voles are loners. But if you treat them with oxytocin, their behavior changes dramatically, and they start to resemble prairie voles in behavioral style. It is a considerable stretch from voles to humans, but people release oxytocin during activities when they are close to another person, close in ways as diverse as prayer, sexual intimacy, or even team sports. However, some people do not release oxytocin under such conditions. Not only that, they share many of the characteristics of psychopaths. They are callous and indifferent to others' feelings. Hormones like oxytocin work in conjunction with receptors, and some individuals have a genetic modification in their receptors that make them relatively poor in binding oxytocin. These individuals manifest more callous behaviors even in childhood. Thus, studies are starting to suggest that callous behaviors emerge when the oxytocin level is low or when it is poorly bound to its receptor. The obvious next step has been to manipulate oxytocin levels. When oxytocin is administered, it has direct effects on social behavior, and individuals become more trusting and generous. This was demonstrated in ingenious experiments that employed game theory models. Imagine, for instance, that two subjects are studied in adjacent rooms and allowed to communicate through the computer. Each is given $10. Subject A is told that he or she can donate money to Subject B, and that the money will be tripled when it arrives in B's account. B is told that he or she can keep the money or donate some of it back to A. In this case, there will be no tripling of funds. Thus, if A donates $2 to B, B will have $16, and if Subject B gives $3 back to A, both will be ahead. A will have $11, and B will have $13. How much money will A give to B or B to A? That question starts to get at issues of trust and generosity. After receiving oxytocin, Subject A's were 80% more generous. A small percentage of Subject B's were untrustworthy and indifferent to their partner. They all kept the money to themselves. Interestingly, these subjects appear to have abnormal oxytocin receptors. Such observations have led investigators to speculate that psychopaths and patients with other personality disorders might benefit from taking oxytocin. Could their indifference toward others improve with oxytocin? One study compared healthy controls and personality disorder patients in terms of their response to emotional stimuli. When viewing angry faces, patients with personality disorder fixated on the angry faces more rapidly, and this intense focus was related to increased activity in their amygdala. However, when these patients were treated with oxytocin, such differences in response patterns disappeared. Even if psychopaths could be reliably diagnosed by their unusual brain structure and function, and even if they have peculiarities in their neuroendocrine physiology, how does this help define their legal responsibility? If Julius Streicher met the criteria for psychopathy, should he have been treated more leniently at Nuremberg? How would a latter-day Streicher be viewed by the courts of today? Forensic views of malice. Euripides' Oresteia focuses on the evolution of law. Without law, the Furies foment an endless cycle of revenge and retribution, and there is no escape until all the involved parties are dead. With law, the perspective changes. Society acts as an impartial judge and imposes terms of settlement or punishment. Should such judgments consider a defendant's mental illness? When patients with mental illness commit crimes, the courts are interested in the defendant's mental state at the time of the crime, and also whether the person can meaningfully participate in the trial. Those are two separate matters, and the rules for deciding such matters vary greatly in different jurisdictions. The Nuremberg Tribunal grappled with this problem, particularly in the case of Rudolf Hess. But this controversial issue has much older legal precedents. Daniel McNaughton had been delusional for years before he shot and killed Edmund Drummond in 1843. We would not remember this case except that Drummond was Prime Minister Robert Peel's assistant, and it wasn't clear which of the two men was actually McNaughton's target. Even back in the 19th century, the courts were prepared to exonerate McNaughton if it could be shown that he was mentally ill, but that entailed demonstrating that he was raving mad, impulsive, and unreachable to human discourse. McNaughton, however, was quietly psychotic and was convinced that unnamed others were watching him and bothering him. He had lashed out at Drummond, who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. The court found the evidence of his partial insanity persuasive, and rather than pronounce McNaughton guilty and hang him, they sent him to a psychiatric hospital where he was locked up for the rest of his life. The judges wrote that in McNaughton's case, reason is not driven from her seat, but distraction sits down upon her. A delusion carried him away beyond the power of his own control over acts which had connection with his delusion. Queen Victoria was so furious about this decision that she wrote a friend, "What did the jury mean by saying he was not guilty? I will never believe that anyone could be not guilty who wanted to murder a conservative prime minister." The storm died down, and for the next 100 years some variant of the McNaughton rule was accepted by many courts. Insanity meant that a person's mental illness prevented the defendant from understanding the nature of his or her actions, and the defendant was not guilty by virtue of insanity. In many jurisdictions today, a mental illness defense is limited to mitigating the verdict. Instead of being ruled not guilty by virtue of mental illness, one is judged guilty and mentally ill. The sentence might be shorter, or the person might be sent to a special prison for the criminally insane, but he or she would still be convicted and sequestered. In Chapter 4, I mentioned Justice Robert Jackson's reservations about psychological testing of the war criminals. He feared that this might open up a Pandora's box of controversy, that dueling psychiatric experts would derail the trial. It was a prescient observation. For years, the courts have been struggling with such issues, particularly in cases of severe personality disorders, and certainly some of the Nuremberg defendants seem to fall in this category. Given the diverse associations between psychopathy and the brain, one can anticipate exactly how the defense might have argued. Even back in 1962, prominent forensic psychiatrist Bernard Diamond contended, "Their appearance of normalcy, their apparent ability to exercise free will and choice, is purely a facade, an artifact that conceals the extent to which they are victims of their own brain pathology." When the American serial killer John Wayne Gacy came to trial in 1980, many psychiatric witnesses were called by the defense, testifying about his psychiatric disorders and his abusive childhood. They argued that he was a pseudo-neurotic paranoid schizophrenic, or a borderline personality organization with a subtype of antisocial or psychopathic personality manifested by episodes of an underlying condition of paranoid schizophrenia, or that he was paranoid, obsessive, narcissistic, polymorphously perverse, and fearful of his sexuality. In short, he was eaten up by his raging illness. The prosecution was more succinct. Gacy was evil. The jury agreed with the prosecution. The contemporary studies of neural imaging, brain hormones, and psychopathy are inevitably making their way into the courts and have led to a new field in criminal cases, neurolaw. If the brain of a psychopathic defendant is unusual, should this inform deliberations about criminal responsibility, culpability, or punishment? A study published in Science examined the impact of the bad brain defense on sentencing. Judges were asked to determine the sentence of a hypothetical criminal described to some as a violent psychopath and to others as a psychopath with defective brain functioning. Being described as a psychopath with its characteristic features of lack of remorse or empathy led to a long jail sentence. In contrast, being described as a psychopath with a bad brain was regarded as a mitigating factor. The judges imposed a lighter sentence, reasoning that the defendant lacked control and it wasn't entirely the defendant's fault. That is, he or she had a sick brain. Neurolaw antedates the advent of fMRI machines by millennia. After all, in Timaeus, Plato argued, "No man is voluntarily bad, but the bad becomes the bad by reason of an ill disposition of the body." To use Rebecca Goldstein's felicitous rephrasing of Plato, the 21st century neurolaw argument would be, "My amygdala made me do it." Conclusion. At Nuremberg, there was a clash of ideology between those who regarded malice as categorically distinct and those who saw it on a continuum of behavior. This chapter has summarized the intellectual strands that regard malice as categorically distinct. How well did these descriptions fit the four war criminals? Hermann Göring was viewed as a classical, charming, narcissistic psychopath whose actions were premeditated and cold-blooded. Julius Streicher was almost demonic in his hot-blooded impulsivity. Robert Ley certainly had a brain injury that altered his behavior, but paradoxically, he was also the most remorseful defendant at Nuremberg. Rudolf Hess was an enigma, but most observers thought that he suffered from a delusional disorder. As far as the court was concerned, Göring's and Streicher's diagnoses were irrelevant for their sentencing. Because Ley killed himself before the trial started, the tribunal never ruled in his case. The tribunal considered psychiatric status as a mitigating factor for Hess alone. At Nuremberg, we naively believed that there would be answers if psychiatrists and psychologists could examine the defendants. In fact, what emerged were diagnoses, but they were hardly revelatory about the origins of malice. Today, there is an international war crimes tribunal at The Hague. To my knowledge, neurolaw arguments have not been introduced at The Hague. It's only a matter of time. Conclusion. You will say I have robbed you of your sleep, but these are things which have turned the stomach of the world. Justice Robert Jackson, Testimony, International Military Tribunal, November 21, 1945. Looking back. 40 years ago, I promised the Nuremberg executioner that I would study the Nazi perpetrators. I dodged the task for years. I had other responsibilities, patients to treat, students to teach, research to do, a family to raise. Yet I kept running into malice and suffering in the lives of my patients and in the news of the day. By happenstance along the way, I met some extraordinary people who were witness to it all. They're gone now, and I realized that if I didn't start writing, their stories would disappear with me. Since I have done research most of my professional life, my first impulse was to delve into archives. Research is inherently unpredictable, and archival research is particularly so because archives are typically uncatalogued, unexplored, and frequently located in unusual locations. Of course, the Library of Congress and the National Archives have vaults of information about Nazi war crimes. But my search also took me to improbable places, like the University of Akron, attics in Berkeley, coffeehouses in San Diego, living rooms in Jerusalem, Rohnert Park, California, and Silver Spring, Maryland. I became steeped in documents from the mid-1940s. As World War II was drawing to a close, the world was haunted. How could a civilized country undertake such a concerted plan of mass killing? How could Nazi leaders continue on this lethal business even when it wasn't in Germany's best interest? It seemed mad. Even before the war ended, psychiatry and psychology began promising to study the psychology of the Nazi leaders. Rudolf Hess's behavior was so bizarre that it suggested profound mental illness. Hermann Göring had a past history of psychiatric hospitalization and continuing drug abuse. Julius Streicher's rap sheet of depravity was very long, and he was so self-destructive that he antagonized everyone. Robert Ley's alcoholism and brain injury led to aberrant behavior, and he was crippled by depression. All of this was obvious to everyone, but there was an expectation that professional study would somehow reveal more. At Nuremberg, two brilliant young doctors, as different as night is from day, stepped into that arena to scrutinize the war criminals. I think each of them found what he was looking for, even if it wasn't the same thing. Douglas Kelly found a collection of hoodlums and moral cripples who, had luck been with the world, would have led their shabby lives as private citizens and not governmental leaders. Luck was not with us, and they used their skills to orchestrate mass killing. Gustav Gilbert found not hoodlums, but depraved psychopaths who bore the mark of Cain. Kelly and Gilbert spoke with great assurance, ignoring the fact that they were extrapolating on the basis of a small sample. The Nuremberg defendants were ideologically committed opportunists, upper-level managers who designed, facilitated, and fomented the deaths of millions, but had little to do with the day-to-day operations. As Justice Robert Jackson observed, these defendants were men of a station and rank which does not soil its own hands with blood. They were men who knew how to use lesser folk as tools. Kelly's and Gilbert's findings might have been different had they examined those men and women whose fingers were on the triggers. That, however, is a different question. Neither Kelly nor Gilbert took into account that psychological testing in a dank prison might have influenced their observations. The prisoners had witnessed the total defeat of their regime and personal hopes. They were imprisoned in solitary cells for months and faced probable death sentences. How much confidence can we have in a Rorschach test administered under such circumstances? Would the testing results in Nuremberg really explain what the defendants were like while they were in power? In his opening statement, Prosecutor Jackson soberly noted, "In the prisoner's dock sit 20-odd broken men, reproached by the humiliation of those they have led, almost as bitterly as by the desolation of those they have attacked. Their personal capacity for evil is forever past. It is hard now to perceive in these miserable men as captives the power by which, as Nazi leaders, they once dominated much of the world and terrified most of it." Jackson's observation pointed out the challenges that faced the psychiatrists and psychologists of Nuremberg. Under the circumstances, how valid would their observations be? Kelly and Gilbert were certainly aware that their testing conditions were non-standard, but they pragmatically continued as best as they could. This is hardly the stuff of modern research. No randomized clinical trials here. It was, however, a step in the right direction. For millennia, cultures have speculated about why people do despicable things. Traditional explanations have included possession by the gods or madness. At Nuremberg, possession did not seem a credible explanation, and madness did not seem a very accurate descriptor in the technical sense of the word for most of the prisoners. Psychiatry and psychology offered a new way of examining the prisoners, and the Rorschach test in particular promised a glimpse into their unconscious. But the test itself was so sensitive to the interpreter's judgment that no consensus could be reached about the Nazi leaders. People were expecting malice to be monochromatic. What emerged instead was a spectrum of behaviors and disorders as the basis of malice. Observers were taken by surprise and responded with vituperative disagreement. Cultural templates for malice. While it may be more reassuring to think that the war criminals were a diabolical and homogeneous group, that belief is an illusion. It doesn't even work that way in film. Our iconic images of monster in film and literature, Frankenstein, 1818, Dracula, 1897, and Jekyll and Hyde, 1886, may all share the name monsters, but they differ profoundly from one another. In Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the monster was man-made. Dr. Victor Frankenstein was misguided, but he was ultimately responsible for the actions of his creature. In a similar vein, the Nuremberg war criminals brought the mass killings to life by fomenting mass murder, and they were held responsible for the ensuing carnage. This was the view of Justice Jackson and the tribunal. Bram Stoker's Dracula, however, was an entirely different monster, definitely an alien other. He was not man-made. And although his origin was ultimately unclear, his essence was distinctly demonic. This representation of a monster who was other corresponds to Gustav Gilbert's view of the war criminals as psychopaths, so distinctly other that they shared nothing in common with the rest of us. Last, the monster in Robert Louis Stevenson's story of the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is neither created by man nor an alien other, but lies within. This is perhaps the most terrifying monster of all, because if the monster Hyde can lurk within Jekyll, then Hyde can lurk in anyone. This was the alarming conclusion that Douglas Kelly propounded. Anyone, any one of us, could become a war criminal given the wrong set of circumstances. Speculations on a latter-day Nuremberg. So the battle raged at Nuremberg and beyond to define the contours of malice. Recently, I began to wonder how these points would be argued in contemporary war crimes trials. In 2012, forensic psychologists reviewed recent international war crimes trials and commented with surprise that so far, there are no empirical psychological studies in the persons convicted of war crimes. Today, we would employ vastly better tools than our colleagues had in 1945. We could use structured psychiatric interviews to define more precisely the nature of the defendant's psychiatric history and diagnosis. That may sound like a simple change, but such standardization represents a profound advance in psychiatry and psychology. In addition, we could use neural imaging to characterize the defendant's brain structure and response to tasks that elicit impulsivity or empathy. All this information would surely be introduced as evidence. Even if the tribunal had such new evidence, my hunch is that the judgments would have been the same as those reached in 1946. Hess might have been confined for life in a psychiatric hospital as opposed to a Spandau-like prison. Goering would have been executed or sentenced to life imprisonment, although he still might have killed himself with contraband drugs. Stryker would have been executed or imprisoned for life, but given his abrasive tactlessness, he probably would not have lasted long in prison. Lay is the great mystery. A tribunal today would hesitate over his fate because he was so profoundly remorseful. That remorse, combined with a documented record of his severe head injury, might have resulted in a shorter prison sentence. While these more contemporary analyses will surely be used in future war crimes trials, the question is, will anyone bother to do the research? Nuremberg represented a rare convergence of unusual elements. First, there was an international consensus that the trials were necessary. Second, physicians and social scientists, as well as officials at the highest levels of government, all agreed that study of the war criminals was crucial. Last, that agreement would have come to naught were it not for the serendipitous presence of two gifted, stubborn, argumentative individuals, Kelly and Gilbert, who led that inquiry. Will we ever see such an improbable confluence at The Hague on the occasion of future war crimes trials? Afterward. I was on another improbable quest for answers. What is it about this topic that leads to archives in such improbable places? This time, I was back home in California, walking through the redwood trees that stand like sentinels around the library at UC Santa Cruz. A subdued light filtered through the moist early morning air, and the groves were filled with the scent of the redwoods and caws from the Steller's jays. I had come to the library in the hopes of learning more about Malice. For unclear reasons, its archives held some of Douglas Kelly's papers. The files were useful in revealing more information about Kelly, magician, astronomer, television producer, raconteur, but included few new documents pertinent to Nuremberg. I was, of course, disappointed, but then I started to reflect. Would any archives have answered my questions about Malice? The Bible says pointedly, "The dark places of the earth are full of the habitations of cruelty." Psalms, chapter 74, verse 80. The poet Pablo Neruda concludes more hopefully, "The earth is a bed, blooming for love, soiled in blood." Kelly found some darkness in every prison. Gilbert found a unique darkness in some. They were both right. This has been an Audible Studios production of The Anatomy of Malice, The Enigma of the Nazi War Criminals, written by Joel E. Dimsdale, performed by J.P. Guimont, producer Mike Charzik, copyright 2016 by Yale University, production copyright 2016 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.